This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elaine Pagels, is a historian of the ancient world. She's the author of The Gnostic Gospels, which won a National Book Award, and Adam, Eve, and the Serpent. Her intellectual world was shaken by two personal tragedies in the late 1980s. Her six-year-old son died of a respiratory illness. About a year and a half later, her husband died in a hiking accident. She says that after her husband died, she became aware that she was living in the presence of an invisible being. That is, she was living with a vivid sense of someone who had died. During the following years, she began to reflect on the ways that religious traditions give shape to the invisible world, and how our imaginative perceptions of what is invisible shape the ways we respond to events in the natural world. She also found herself reflecting on the ways that people from Greek, Jewish, and Christian traditions deal with misfortune and loss and evil. This led her to write her new book, The Origin of Satan.
When people experience some unexpected misfortune, they often respond as if it's their fault or somebody else's fault or some, you know, the universe's fault or God's fault or something like that. And it struck me, although I'd never believed that, that this is like a cultural reflex, you know, that this conviction that somehow the universe has a moral structure. And when that accident happened and devastated my life, I was married to my late husband for 20 years, and it was quite extraordinary. I found that even though I didn't believe in that, you know, that it was anybody's fault, he was a physicist working on chaos theory at the time, as a matter of fact, certainly knew he didn't believe that. It was just dealing with an unexpected sort of universe. That came up as a kind of cultural reflex, and I found for me it was not helpful. And one thing I had to do with it was to look at the way I had learned culturally this kind of reflex.
What wasn't helpful? What reflex wasn't helpful?
The belief that it was somebody's fault that these things happen. Mm-hmm. And I needed to look at that and put it aside. And one way of doing that was to look at how that view came into our culture. That's one part of it. The book also came out of another kind of very visceral perception, which happens, I'm sure you know, when you suddenly lose someone you love very much, especially someone you're very close to and live with. Then it's as though the person is there, but they're not there. It's a very strange perception, and accommodating oneself to that loss is a very long-term process. And when I said I felt as though I were living in the presence of an invisible being, I didn't mean literally that I thought he was, you know, sitting over my shoulder, but simply that I was aware of his presence a great deal and then aware of his absence a great deal. And after that thought, you know, considerably later, I realized that in the ancient world, which I study sort of as a historian, virtually everybody thought that there were invisible beings in the world. Whether you were Egyptian or Greek or Babylonian or Jewish or Christian, almost everyone accepted that.
Now, where does Satan come in and what you were going through emotionally when you decided to write the book?
Well, I think the figure of Satan had to do with conflict, it had to do with distress to some extent, but also had to do with this cultural reflex that, as I said, was not at all useful, which leads a person to think when they have some kind of misfortune like this that, you know, that this is an evil thing or something bad is being done to them. And I started out looking at invisible beings, which for me meant the Greek gods, you know, like Hera and Zeus, Apollo, all of those gods, and then thinking that, but a Jew or a Christian wouldn't look at Greek gods. They were thinking about a universe in which there's a moral order, and it's ruled by God and his angels and so forth. Anyway, so I decided to look at the Greek gods and the angels and demons. Then I was very much surprised to discover that demons and devils are almost non-existent in Jewish tradition. They just aren't there until very, very late, almost until the time of the early Christian era.
Satan, the devil kind of is in the Old Testament through the Job story.
Well, there are stories that talk about a character called HaSatan. It means the adversary. It means, but he's not what we think of as a Satan. He's one of the sons of God. He's an angelic being, a servant of God who does things that people don't like. For example, he can block their path. He can be an obstacle. He, like the angel of death, has an unpleasant job to do. In the book of Job, the Satan isn't against God at all. He's just one of the sons of God, and he asked permission to test Job and see how far this loyal servant of God will last if he has a lot of adversity. But in the story, he's very much under the control of God. What shocked me, surprised me, and intrigued me was that there was no such thing as a Satan in the sense that later Christendom came to know Satan. So that became a puzzle. And then often when in the middle of work like this, you find something you don't expect at all. That's what I didn't expect. And so that became the focus of my work.
When in Christianity you have, Jesus representing, a force of good and Satan representing the force of evil, is that dichotomy, that clear division between good and evil, something new?
It looks new to me. I mean, I don't know where else to find it in the ancient world. I mean, even in the God of Israel, one finds wrath, one finds blessing. But in that dichotomy, I think it is new. It's an interesting question.
Elaine Pagels is my guest, and she's a historian of the ancient world. Her new book is called The Origin of Satan. You've been studying the ancient world, studying the history of religion for many years. And I actually want to broaden this discussion into some work that you did interpreting ancient texts that were discovered very recently, back in the mid-1940s. I believe they're known as the Nag Hammadi Library.
Yes, that's right.
Before we talk about their writings about Satan and evil, these are Gnostic texts. Would you explain what Gnostic texts are?
Yes. Well, agnostic means somebody who claims not to know about ultimate reality. A Gnostic is somebody who claims to have some knowledge. Gnosis is a Greek word for knowledge, but it doesn't mean intellectual knowledge. It doesn't mean like scientific knowledge or mathematical knowledge. It means a knowledge of relationship, like the kind of word you'd use do you know this person? Yes, I know that person. So it's a relational knowledge. I think maybe the word insight is better. So these are people who claim certain kinds of spiritual insight, but they also claim to be Christians who had insights particularly about Jesus and the disciples that were not given to everybody. In that find, there were 52 ancient texts that claim to go back to the beginning of the Christian era. There are gospels about Jesus. There are secret dialogues between him and disciples. There are letters from one apostle to another, the secret book of John, so forth.
Is it fair to call the Gnostics people who were more mystical in their approach?
They look very much like their writings certainly tend toward some kind of mystical understanding. I think they're also related to Jewish mysticism. But if you know Buddhism, you'll see a resonance there, as many people have.
Well, you've concluded that the Christianity may have been more diversified in its very early expressions than it is even today.
Well, I think it was, because when you look at these other Gospels, you find that the range of traditions about Jesus is just enormously fascinating and diverse and interesting. And the difference of point of view and perception and opinion is also enormous. That was very much cut down when the church became an organized structure that could agree on unified doctrine all over the world. That's a rather late phenomenon by my standards. It took about 150 years after the death of Jesus, anyway.
Well, give us a sense of what Christianity was like in that 150 years before things were codified.
There were little groups all over the ancient world, from Spain to Africa to what is now France or England, Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, Persia, with very different kinds of rituals, different kinds of beliefs, different kinds of practices. Some were radically ascetic and thought one had to live in celibacy and renunciation and be vegetarian and abstinent in terms of alcohol and meat, as well as sexuality. Others were completely different in their attitudes, and you can see them expressed in the Gospels of the New Testament. But so we have a picture of widely ranging sort of flourishing of a very diverse and interesting movement. What fascinated me was how that changed. And I think because of persecution by the state, it was necessary for many of these groups to consolidate and agree on what they believed and in a way become much more uniform.
You know what I find interesting? These ancient Gnostic texts that you helped interpret, you say that if they were found 1,000 years ago, they would have been destroyed as heretical.
Oh, they were.
Well, what was in them that would have been seen as heretical at the time?
Well, for one thing, some of them, as I say, have very different pictures of the God of Israel. I mean, some of them tell the story of Genesis as though the serpent were the divine voice, feminine divine voice, sometimes revealing the truth. And the God of Israel is sort of like an angry father who's wants to prevent Adam and Eve from waking up and participating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge and spiritual understanding. So there's a contest between this God and the benevolent serpent who's trying to free Adam and Eve from their bondage. That's one kind of thing. But also, and I think much more threatening to what became the emerging church, there are pictures of Jesus here that look much more like a Buddhist view. That is, Jesus not as the only Son of God through whom you must be saved, but Jesus as one who shows the way to the divine source. But what Jesus shows is that you can find the way to that divine source by yourself and within yourself. And to suggest that means that you may not need a priest, you may not need a church, you may not need Jesus for that matter. You just need to go off by yourself in the desert and struggle and meditate and contend with yourself until you find the deeper self within. And that was something that many church leaders thought was blasphemy, was deprecating to Jesus, and absolutely wrong.
My guest is Elaine Pagels. She's the author of the book The Gnostic Gospels and the new book The Origin of Satan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elaine Pagels. She's the author of the new book The Origin of Satan. You say that in these ancient texts, there's often expressed a belief, a celebration of God as both father and mother, as both male and female. What are some of the ways that's expressed?
Well, in the Secret Book of John, there's a remarkable opening of it in which John is grieving, the disciple John after the crucifixion is grieving because Jesus has been killed. And he says he suddenly sees that the earth is trembling and shaken and there's a huge light, an unearthly light shines. And in the light he sees changing forms. And then a voice comes from the light and says, John, John, why do you weep? I'm the one who is with you always. I am the Father, I am the Mother, and I am the Son. Then John realizes that the one who's speaking is Jesus in his three forms. And of course, with the Trinity, you'd think, what is the Trinity? The Father, the Son, who would you expect to find there? I mean, not exactly a Holy Ghost. You'd expect to find Father, Mother, and Son. And that's what you find in these texts, partly because they go back to the Hebrew word for Spirit, Holy Spirit. A feminine word in Hebrew, Ruach, would be interpreted as a divine mother. And so that is interpreted in many of these texts.
Do you find yourself more attracted to this early, more mystical, or more Buddha-like approach to Christianity?
I find myself very much attracted to it. Ever since I read those texts, I felt somehow that I was at home among these very strange flora and fauna. As I said, they are strange and wild, and my professors were saying, well, of course, you know, they're all blasphemy, and they're all heresy, and they're all quite ridiculous. And I was saying, you know, I love these texts, some of them. Some of them are funny. Some of them are sort of startling and unexpected. And others are just absolutely extraordinary. So, yes, I find myself very much attracted to them.
Tell us a little more what they are, when they're from, who wrote them.
We don't really know who wrote them. They probably come from about the 1st to the 3rd century. They're quite a diverse collection. The Gospel of Thomas looks like, and I think is, an early collection of Jesus' sayings. It may include some later sayings, but it's a very interesting early collection of the sayings of Jesus. Some of the ones I like very much are ones like this. Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. There are sayings like that that I found compelling as Zen koan.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thing you can ponder for a very long time.
Yes, that's why I wrote the Gnostic Gospels, because of that saying. But there are many others. For example, there's a wonderful poem called Thunder, Perfect Mind, and this comes from the Greek word bronte, thunder, which was seen by the ancients, whether they were Jewish or Greek, as the voice of the divine. Here the divine voice speaks as a feminine power, and she speaks in a very extraordinary way of the opposites inherent in her contradictory nature, which comprise the whole of being. It's a marvelous poem.
I want to get back to what you say helped to inspire your new book, The Origin of Satan. I mean, you lost your husband, and it was a horrible experience. It made you feel like you were living with kind of his invisible presence even after he died, and you were wondering about the invisible world and the meaning of good and evil and why good things happen, why bad things happen to good people, and so on. So you thought a lot about Satan and expressions of Satan. I'm sure you kept returning to the early Gnostic Gospels as well. Did you get different explanations that came to you through studying both?
Well,
I mean, explanations of how what could have happened to your family happened.
I found that explanations had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Explanations weren't useful. You know, it's like the mind, I found that my mind kept looking for some interpretation of what happened. And then the interpretation would just shatter on with the absolute facts of what had happened. You know, just this happened. That's, the interpretations were quite secondary, and they didn't help me very much at all. But I do find in some of these sources, and particularly actually in the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip, understandings about existence which are helpful.
Did I don't know how religious a person you are, how much your interest in religion is a purely historical, intellectual one. Did you find any comfort in religion?
Well, I started this search of religion as somebody who had come from a sort of liberal but not particularly religious Protestant background. In fact, you know, brought up to think that religion was really for uneducated people and not educated people like ourselves. Kind of snobbish view that you get in academic circles. And I found I was completely fascinated by religion from the time I was quite young. I mean, I loved all kinds of poetry and dance and music. I mean, every kind you can imagine. I know you explore many kinds. But there was something about, say, religious music or dance or architecture or poetry that I just found particularly compelling. And often it was Christian, sometimes it was Hopi or Buddhist or something else. However, because this is the culture that I live with and was brought up with, it was what engages me very deeply.
Do you participate in any religious rituals, or is it a more intellectual pursuit?
Well, I do now. I didn't used to, but I've been going to various kinds of meditation practice. Sometimes to the Quaker meeting house in Princeton, to the Episcopal Church there, which has an extraordinary liturgy. There are a group of Roman Catholic monks whose worship is very deep and powerful and means a great deal to me as well.
Part of what we turn to religion for is, I think, not only to explain things to ourselves, but also to explain things to children. I know you have children, and you lost your husband. You also lost a 6-year-old son a few years ago.
Yes.
To illness. Did you find yourself turning to religion at all to help explain these losses to your children?
Well, let me say this. What I was trying to say before is that it doesn't seem to me it helps much to try to explain these losses. One has to live with them. Even though we can't explain them, at least I can't explain them, one has to live with them. And in living with them, living with the fact that they've happened, that they do happen, and they're not unusual, There I found meditation, for example, and prayer to be essential. And I've brought my children into that process because I think it's going to be essential for them as well in understanding, you know, how we can deal with our lives. So when I say it's not useful for explaining, I mean something kind of intellectual by explaining. You know, the mental explanation doesn't help me very much. But in living with some reality like that, I find these religious means essential.
What are your most fulfilling experiences in a place of worship?
That's an interesting question. Or outside of a place of worship, I would say hiking up in the mountains is one of them. Sitting in meditation with other people who deeply know how to do that. I was thinking of a monastery in Colorado, which has an extraordinary depth to it as a place to meditate. So, and the third would be the extraordinary music that comes out of Christian tradition, particularly for me. Some amazing music that I very much love.
You mentioned hiking in the mountains, and if you don't mind my mentioning
this,
I know your husband died in a hiking accident.
Yes.
And the fact that you would continue to hike and to feel that was among your most spiritual experiences is really interesting. I mean, a lot of people would just be afraid to set foot on rocky slopes again after.
Well, that may be, but it was very much a kind of spiritual home that we shared, and I feel that those mountains are a remarkable place. When I do hike, I hike on trails and in places which have no drop-off. I don't take chances with my life because I know that sometimes, you know, we don't get a second chance with those things, and I have my children to be responsible to and my husband and the whole family.
Elaine Pagels, she's the author of the new book, The Origin of Satan. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.